Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to New Breed Film Reviews. This is Dave, and I'm on a podcast with Don. Don's back.
What's up?
So, this episode, it's fun. Don came up with a cool theme for the episode. And, when he mentioned his topic, I was like, dude, that's a great one. So the theme of this episode is, nuclear bunker films. And what that means, what that means is if there was like a nuclear holocaust or whatever, and we have to go in underground bunkers for the rest of our lives alone, what are five movies that we would bring with us to watch for eternity or for the rest of our natural lives?
Five movies forever.
Forever. So Don and I were talking about this before getting on, and it was kind of hard for us to pick because I have a top 10, but they're all kind of interchangeable. So we're probably going to come back to this and do like a volume two, volume three with like the rest of the boys and stuff. And, but it was fun. I mean, some of my movies are deep. Some of them are just for entertainment. And, I'll let Don kick it off with this first film. Okay. What were your picks based on? Entertainment or like what?
This is actually a good thing to cover. I'm glad you asked that because initially when we were, because we've been talking about this for a couple of weeks now, and initially it was just going to be my top all-time movies. And the more you think about it, the more you go, well, if I'm going to be stuck in a bunker, even a great movie like Saving Private Ryan, I'm not going to watch it forever. You know, that's a way too intense movie. So I based them on different categories, at least these five. So I got, you know, one or two of my serious ones that I really, really like that I have a lot of respect for, like art house style. And then, you know, one that's a lighter comedy, another one that may be considered not necessarily in this group, but I'll go into that when we hit it. You know, so it's just, it's based on, excuse me, myriad, things. So just, you know, it's one of those things. If you're going to have it forever and you're stuck in a bunker with these five ones, you don't just want, you know, really awesome war movies, or else you might end up, you know, killing yourself or something, stuck in a bunker forever. So I tried to cover as much spectrum as I could in just five choices. Mm-hmm. So you want me to lead off with the first one that I got?
Sure.
All right. So I'm just going to go for, I have more serious than I do not serious. So one of them is going to be a Tarantino classic, Pulp Fiction. I think it's one of my all time favorites, you know, that one, like the highest award in the Cannes Film Festival. And you just, you know, if you're going to be locked in a bunker, you may as well have some ultra violence, crazy Tarantino, non-linear storytelling. You can't beat Pulp Fiction. That's just a solid movie.
That's an awesome pick. I haven't seen Pulp Fiction in years. I may have to revisit it since you brought it up. When I first really started getting into movies and like appreciating them, not for just like, face value entertainment, but like when I really started getting into them, Pulp Fiction just like stood out and I was like, just like, whoa, like Tarantino's freaking amazing. And then I became like a really big Tarantino fan, but that movie's fun. It's layered. It's entertaining. It's so well done. That's the one where Christopher Walken tells the story about the watch.
The watch in the ass. Okay. He goes, this is your daddy's war watch, which is actually a reference to a real thing that was issued to soldiers before they went out. That's how layered Tarantino movies are. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but yes, that is the one that pretty much begins the movie, or the battle that Bruce Willis's character is going to have to take through the movie, much like his father did back in Vietnam.
Yeah, man, that's a great pick. I think Bruce Willis did awesome in that movie also. His whole
everybody, story. Even John Travolta. I mean, who the hell is
that
he
was
before
his comeback
Pulp Fiction?
Movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Johnny Boy was, not to cut you off, but he was out of the limelight for a while, and that movie put him on the map again.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody else, Vin Rames, I mean, you name it, everybody played a good part. I mean, especially the direction. Like I said, you just can't, for me, if I'm going to go into a bunker, give me Pulp Fiction. You know, that's one of those ones that I can always rely on. Like you said, there's action. There's a bit of comedy where you can find it. You know, it's very layered. And it's one of those ones, too, that you're going to be able to chew on forever. So if you're stuck in a bunker, you may as well have something heavily layered that you can sit there and break apart for eternity.
Mm-hmm. And, dude, Tarantino style, I don't think he's the first person to do it, but he's probably one of the ones to, like, master it where, like, he doesn't shoot a movie, like, linear. That's, like, an order, right?
Right. So he does nonlinear.
Yeah, nonlinear. So like, he may not be the first person to do it, but he's definitely a master at it. And I love the way how he links, you know, the portions of the movie, and it all makes sense and it just flows well. He's amazing, man. To me, he's underrated. Like, and I know he's won like awards and stuff like that, but Tarantino, to me, he'll go down as like one of the greats, like ever. Call me crazy.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, I think he's I don't want to say a modern day Kubrick because he does different things, but I do think he will go down in infamy, very similar as to the way Stanley Kubrick's name is tossed around in film schools. Mm-hmm. You know,
dude, can't beat Stanley. That. Stanley Kubrick, I'm familiar with Full Metal Jacket, 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's the title, right? I've seen that.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. I got really into it. I don't remember every aspect of it in detail, but I remember it was like a super deep, like out there movie. And I did like it a lot. Full Metal Jacket's like an amazing movie to me. But Full Metal Jacket's weird, dude. It's like, it's almost like two movies. Like, I like the first half more, you know, with the whole boot camp and Private Pile.
Yeah. Very famous.
Yeah. What is your major malfunction? Arlie Ermey. Yeah, he was actually a real drill sergeant.
I heard that. Yeah, that Full Metal Jacket, another great movie, but one I wouldn't want to take down to a bunker to watch forever. You know,
it's probably not a good choice.
Not unless you want to commit suicide in like 5 years. I'm looking for longevity, you know?
Mm-hmm. Dude, Pulp Fiction, how about this? How about one of the most quoted scenes in like movie history? Samuel L. Jackson, you know?
Say what again?
Say what again, motherfucker? Dude, that scene right there is, I mean, everybody's seen it. Whether you've seen Pulp Fiction or not, I know you've seen clips, you know, portions of that scene with Samuel L., you know, where it's like Jerry Curl and his gun and then the suit. Yeah.
Or even the meme, like the meme is so pervasive online with, you know, Sam Jackson with the gun and the suit and usually says, say something again, whatever the case is. Like that's not just like,
I think it was
movie
what?
Canon, that's pop culture, you know, history right there.
Yeah, I think it was sounding them say what? Say what again, motherfucker?
No, it is say what again, but usually, I mean, I've seen it before substituted for other things like, notification again, or, you know, say Trump again, or whatever the case is, you know, insert this phrase here. That's what I'm saying. That actually, you know, what he did there was transferred from some type of like movie cinema history into pop culture history. I mean, that's made it staple pretty much, I think, permanently.
Mm-hmm. You want to understand Americans? Watch that clip. For you foreigners listening.
Yeah. For the people who eat the McRoyals. McRoyale. Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese. Yep. And then his whole religious speech, dude, his little like line.
God, I wish I could remember that. Yeah.
So iconic. But props to the writing and props for Samuel L. Jackson's delivery, because he's probably one of the few people on earth that can pull that off, like as an actor, you know?
So, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome pick though, dude. My first pick, and this is like not in any kind of order. I just kind of plucked five out of my top 10, and I didn't pick them for entertainment. They're literally like some of my favorite movies. Drive. And it's funny because you just saw Drive.
Yep.
And you enjoyed it. And Drive is like one of my top 10 films of all time. I'm an 80s baby. Dating myself right here, and it has kind of like 80s vibe to it, like certain like 80s elements. I don't even know if it's set in the 80s or not, but it was just so, Drive is so layered and so well done. Ryan Gosling did great, like acting. It has just the right amount of action, just the right amount of violence, just the right amount of love. And I'm not even to like love stories, but Drive is like amazing to me, and I've said this, I'm gonna shut up right now, but it's one of the best movies that conveys like emotion without words, like to me. And I repeated this before on a show where, like, you know, those moments where like you're digging on someone and you're kind of giddy like inside, and you give each other like that look, like the movie captured what they were thinking without like saying it. And you know exactly what they were thinking in certain scenes, like Ryan Gosling and his like love interest. And I just love that movie, man. It's awesome. I bought it right away. I own it. You know what I mean? It's one of my faves.
It's seriously a fantastic movie, and I think I might have to watch it one or two more times to pick up on everything going on. Subsurface, I mean, even the stuff that you're talking about, the emotions without words, that literally is the definition of nonverbal storytelling, which is something that I absolutely love. I mean, it's, you can have a director who sets up really cool panning shots or, you know, like crazy angles and spins the camera around and drops it from a crane. But you get a director who can tell you something without telling you it. That's special. That's talent. That's talent right there. You know, that's not just trickery. What they're doing is they're setting up a scene. They're setting up this textualization, and then they're giving it to you without telling you. And that's something Drive did actually very well with what you're talking about. Those long emotional pauses where you can see the torture inside the person's head. And they let you sit there and chew on it. The director was great because he doesn't just, you know, do one jump cut after another during a conversation. If you notice, a lot of his conversations are held in like a wide shot with the two characters in it. And it just gives you this time to digest it in. And it really brings the emotions to the surface and allows you to feel that. And that, you know, is basically nonverbal storytelling. And that's absolutely fantastic. I mean, there's a million other things going on in that movie as well, too. But that is definitely one of the highlights. That's a good pick, yeah.
It has a great cast too. Ron Perlman's in it.
Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston.
Dude, he was stellar.
Yeah, he was great in that movie.
I think he stole scenes from Gosling, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
Yeah, so for you guys listening, Don and I, we don't really have like a debate, but we have a difference of opinion on like Ryan Gosling's character. Like, I flat out think the guy was like the definition of like a sociopath. Like he had like little emotion, and the way I interpreted it was he was so fixated on her because like she brought something out of him and like kind of like made him feel human, like love and stuff. And but for the most part throughout the movie, he was a stone cold, like, you know, killer. Like literally, like he was just like no emotion, did what he had to do in the moment. And there were scenes where like it shocked her. Like, she didn't even realize, like, how violent he was and, like, crazy, like, but...
Oh, that's actually a really well-done scene, not to interrupt you, but when he stomps the dude in the elevator, spoilers, by the way, when he stomps the dude in the elevator and she steps out, the camera, if you notice, jumps from inside the elevator with bloody Ryan Gosling to outside the elevator with the shock girl. And that shot alone, that him jumping, so you see the nice, warm, amber-colored elevator, and then it goes over to the cold exterior in the, you know, just outside on the other side of the elevator, she's standing outside the elevator and it's all gray and cold and she's in shock. And he's literally sending you into a visual shock as well too, because it's nice and colorful inside the elevator and that's where his like his normal is. And then when she finds out, literally she's physically moving in the movie space outside of him. Do you know what I mean? And they contrast that with the two backgrounds. Not to interrupt, but that was, when I saw that, I was like, damn, that was a great idea. Like, it was really well executed.
Well, dude, and then think about this, like, how the scene is, like, layered, where, like, another director or, like, other writers would just have him beat the crap out of this, like, killer, you know, like, hitman, and just, that'll be it. Like, he'll just, like, beat him up, kill him in the elevator. But before the violence occurred, it was this weird, like, touching, like, lovey-dovey moment. He, like, pushes her to the side. He, like, kisses her softly. And you're like, what the hell's going on? It was, like, inserted in there. And then immediately after that, he just, like, it goes into, like, something totally different, violence. And he just, like, stomps this guy his head and crushes it. And, you know, like I said, like, that's, like, awesome writing to me, you know, and directing and...
Well, this is where our difference of opinion comes in, because I think... The reason he's so upset in the movie is because he knows that, unfortunately, to save the girl and the child and to get out of the situation he's in, he has to commit atrocities. He has to commit to aberrant behavior. So, you know, whereas obviously I think his character had a bit of a Northeastern accent, which I think is interesting because they never explain where he came from, in the movie at least. And when he's there, he's very quiet. He's to himself, which I don't think is necessarily a sociopath. I know a lot of friends that are like that. He honestly reminded me of a Formula One driver by the name of Kimi Raikkonen. If you ever get a chance to look up an interview of that guy, it's almost the same as Ryan Gosling in Driver. But not to veer too far off, but I do think, though, that he was fine and he was happy with the girl and he wasn't necessarily a sociopath. But the only way, once he got involved with everything, the only way to correct any of that was to kill the guys to save her. And he knew that by doing that, he was going to lose her. That's why he was so angry. That's why he touched her and kissed her in the elevator, because he knew it was his last opportunity. And he hated that. And that's why he was so angry stomping the guy's face in, because he literally blames them for ruining his opportunity. You know, that's how I see it. It's not that he's necessarily a sociopath. It's that he knows that in order to save everybody, he has to do bad things. And it makes him upset because he doesn't want to.
See, like, I don't know. There's a lot of scenes in that movie. He's kind of a weird individual. He's like kind of withdrawn. And then he just kind of like lashes out with like violence. And, like there's a scene, for the people who haven't seen it, we're probably like ruining stuff for you, but it's a great movie. It's a good watch.
Ruining just a little bit.
Yeah. There's the scene where he's in the diner, you know, he's kind of frustrated with the situation with the girl because she's like that dumbass standard came back into the picture, and he's sitting at the diner, and then a guy approaches him, hey, I remember you, like whatever, and he just lashes out at the dude and tells him basically he's gonna kick his effing teeth in if he doesn't like sit down. But he was like so calm and just like chill like prior to that. And what was another crazy scene with him? Dude, the hotel. You know, when he was like interrogating the chick.
Yeah.
And he calmly puts the glove on. It's like he has like no empathy or emotion. He just basically handles business, like, you know, how he sees fit. But
I do think he has emotion, and that is signified by him taking, like he slaps the girl. He literally like punches the girl in the face, and that's an act of passion. You know, when you're talking, like a police were to come in, and they say, oh, he shot somebody from across the room. Well, that's a detached action. This guy got up in that girl's face and punched her and held her and choked her throat. To me, that's passion. Like, that's him caring, not so cold and calculated. I get what you're saying, but this is the great thing, too. This discussion that we have is because the movie is so great. You know, I hope people realize that this movie allows for this conversation. A lot of modern movies don't allow for that. They tell you exactly what to think, you know, and what's going on at all times. And this movie has just allowed us to talk about this for a few weeks, which is just signals how great it is and what a good choice it is, to be honest.
Yeah, dude, but the hotel scene when he like smacked the mess out of her, and then like those guys came in, the hitmen, and they shot the girl. Dude, when he took them out and he had like blood on his face and he peers like out of the bathroom, like, that's not normal.
Yeah.
He was like in a state of, it wasn't like shock. It was like,
aggression. Like, it was like predatory.
Yeah, exactly. It was like a weird feral state he was in. Like, you know, blood on his face, like very primal. It was like, that movie's insane, man. Like,
yeah. And like, the other thing too, not to ruin it too much, but the great thing is he has a scorpion on his back the whole time, and it reminds me of the story of the scorpion who needs to get across the river to survive. And he gets a ride on the back of, I can't remember if it's a frog or an alligator, and he goes, I need to get a ride across. And he goes, fine, as long as you don't sting me. And he goes, okay, I won't sting you. And so he gets the ride across the river. Once he gets to the other side of the river, he stings the frog or the alligator, whichever one it was. And the alligator or the frog says, why did you do that? He goes, because it's in my nature and I can't help it. And I think that's that whatever that old adage story is actually imparted upon his character. And it shows in that jacket of his that he wears when he gets real aggressive.
Yeah, what I got from the jacket it was funny, too, because it was like kind of like a colorful, it was a bright yellow scorpion with a textured kind of padded jacket. It was kind of, it was very 80s looking and like non-threatening, but the scorpion was kind of like almost hinted like an underlying like danger with him. Like, because scorpions are dangerous, and you see a scorpion on his jacket, it's like, it's like a fun jacket and colorful, but it's a scorpion.
Not to interrupt, but I'm telling you too, I told this to you and I want to bring it up before I forget it to the viewers. If they ever watch this, notice that there is an amber colored light. Whoever did this, whether it was the director or the lighting guy, cinematographer, there's an amber colored light that follows that jacket around the entire movie. And that signifies to me, like you were saying, that jacket signifies when he gets violent and bad and menacing. And if you notice, even when the girlfriend has it, she has an amber light, and Ryan Gosling's not touching it, he's in normal light. And then when they wrap the kid in it and they're bringing him into his bedroom and he's asleep, the kid is bathed in amber light. And even when, like, Mel Brooks near the end is going to go kill Bryan Cranston, he's bathed in that amber light as well, too. But that pretty much follows that whole jacket around, and I think that's to kind of symbolize that whole thing that you were talking about, that the jacket is kind of a metaphor for that aggression or that kind of menacing, you know, tone or feel or whatever the case is. Sorry, but continue on. I didn't mean to interrupt there.
And then call me crazy also with the jacket, but I noticed, like, as the movie progressively spiraled towards, like, more violence, like, the jacket got bloodier and grittier, and it just got more, not tattered, but it got, like, dingy and bloody, and to me, it was, like, it, like, paralleled, like, what was going on in the movie. Of course, he's wearing the jacket while he's doing all this stuff, but...
Yeah, that's gonna happen.
It started off all clean and colorful, and then it turned into, like, this mucked-up, bloody jacket, and he was still wearing it. He was walking around wearing his freaking jacket, which is kind of weird.
And I'm pretty sure, too, I might have to rewatch, but I'm pretty sure as the movie progresses, the soundtrack goes away from 80s music and morphs into more modern-day use of classical music over the scenes, which could be a clue to it, to something else going on in the story that I have theories about, but I'm not 100%. I'd have to rewatch again. But it is something I noticed, that as the movie goes on, there's less of the 80s theme music and more of modern classical stuff. And then, well, obviously, when the credits roll, it goes right back to the 80s stuff. So just something interesting. But, fantastic movie all around.
We could probably spend, eternity on Drive. So, but anyway, that was my first pick. And what you got?
I'm probably going to go with another pseudo-serious but comedic, black comedy film, and that's going to be Dr. Strangelove, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Learn to Love the Bomb. If you've ever seen it, it's an old black-and-white Stanley Kubrick movie, and it's a comedy, but it's not. It's like a black comedy, more or less. It's a dark, dark, dark comedy, but it's funny because it takes place about the potential of nuclear annihilation and how it's just made by a couple of jackasses in the government, really just deciding things on a whim, more or less. That's one of those movies that if I were to go down to a bunker, I would want with me, because that's also another one that was made a long time ago, like I said, and it is still relevant to this day with the modern politics that we have going on and the jackasses that we have running the place. Mm-hmm. So, and that, the way they come about their decisions is, I mean, if you were to watch the movie, which I'm guessing you probably haven't seen, Dr. Strangelove, right?
No, I haven't seen that, no. I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
It's fantastic. If you ever get a chance, you should watch it, you know, download it or rent it or buy it. I'm sure you can get it at Walmart for like $5, but it's very iconic in movie canon. It's a classic. It's enjoyable. It's hilarious. The actor Peter Sellers is in it, and he plays seriously maybe 5 different characters in the movie, and he does it so well that you can't tell. You know, it's not like when you watch Eddie Murphy playing Eddie Murphy playing Eddie Murphy in one of those movies, you can kind of tell it's him. This dude is such a morph. He's such a chameleon. You can't really even tell. You have to kind of look for it, I think, because he pulls it off so well. And the whole movie is just fantastically done. And it's got a very famous ending with a guy riding a nuke on into the sunset, more or less. I don't want to totally ruin it for you, but you really, really should check it out. And that would probably be my second pick to go down in the bunker with me.
Interesting. I'll check it out, dude. I'm always up for like a good layered fun movie.
Well, it's, like I said, it's not even just layered. I mean, it is a Kubrick film, but it's so funny though as well too, especially if you pay attention to any part of politics modern and you realize this was made whenever it was made 40 years ago. I can't even remember how old it is now. But it's still relevant to this day and it's hilarious. One of the guys they have there making the decisions was a former Nazi, and he's in a wheelchair, and he keeps trying to make like he's not a Nazi, and he's an American, but he obviously has a German accent, and he's like, he'll start talking, then he'll get really wound up, and then he's like, you know, Sieg Heil! And then he like, you know, has to hold his arm back down. All this stuff, I'm killing the humor, but it's really funny when he does it.
Yeah.
And it's, like I said, it's just, it's very, very awesome, very funny.
dude, to answer your question, I barely follow politics, man. I could give a crap. I feel like, politicians are puppets, and, the president's a puppet. That's what I want to say. So I don't even believe in voting, to be honest. Like, this, you know, this could turn into a something else podcast instead of movies. Yeah, I give a shit about politics, man.
But that's more to the point. Even so, when you say they're puppets, that's exactly playing into the idea of this movie. To be quite frank with you, you know, it just goes to show what jackasses they are and how controlled they are by the other parties and what exactly controls them. Mm-hmm. It's a complete joke, and it's made fun of in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. If you get it, if you watch it, you'll understand. But it's good, and I don't feel like a lot of young movie watchers or people even our age know what the movie is and take the time out to see it. As soon as you say it's in black and white, people are like, no. Oh,
no color?
Yeah.
I'll tell
you.
Count me out.
Which is, you know, it's a great thing too, is that they have a war room where they're making all these decisions in about whether or not they should bomb. I can't remember if it's Russia or whatever the hell it is. And, you know, it's all these generals and it's the president or whoever the case is, all these people in the cabinets and stuff. And, they have a giant table in the war room where they're discussing this stuff. And Stanley Kubrick, granted he knew it was going to be a black and white movie, he still made the table felt green. And the reason he did that was because he wanted the actors to feel like they were playing a game like poker or roulette or whatever it is. So the whole table, even though you as a viewer can't see it, he did it. And that's how detailed he is on movies, which is to me utterly fascinating, because he wanted to give that sensation that it is a game that they're playing, like it's just like you would if you went to Vegas and you're just blowing $20, you know, is the way they're dropping nukes on people.
That's pretty accurate. Like that's what happens. Like guys sit, you know, around a giant table and they make decisions that affect the world and affect thousands and millions of people. And it's just, you know, exactly how it is. It's a game.
And they ask their prostitute whether or not they should bomb another country, see what she thinks, you know.
pass laws, you know, war against drugs and stuff, and they're like snorting coke themselves. Like it's all a joke, dude.
That's kind of the premise of the movie. So that's what you're talking about, that feeling that you have, that's kind of the deal, and it's more relevant today than ever, I think.
I'll check it out, man. I'll check it out. I ain't scared of black and white. all right, so my second pick, if you're done with this, are you done with that movie?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay. My second pick is The Thing, John Carpenter's remake of it, of the old black and white film. I think it came out in 81, and it's like literally like one of my favorite movies of all time. It stars Kurt Russell, and it's just a great movie, man. You can watch it, and it can be like an awesome horror flick. It has such a great premise to it. It's creepy. I thought the special effects were like way ahead, you know, of its time. I think his name is Rob Bottin is the name of the special effects like artist or whatever. But the movie, I mean, it has a lot going on, you know, with it also. It's not only about like some space monster that takes people over. It has like paranoia elements in it, like claustrophobia, like being isolated. I think the paranoia aspect of the film is what I think is like pretty amazing. Cause like, I don't want to ruin it for the people who haven't seen it, but basically, this military team uncovers this alien that's been buried in the ice for like 100,000 years. And this creature can like infect your body, like even with one cell, and just like take over your body and mimic you. So you don't know who's the alien and who's not. And these guys are stuck in this like Antarctic bunker. So it's a crazy movie, man. There's a lot going on with it. And it's also kind of like a regular horror movie. Like it's gory. It's creepy. It's scary.
It's super tense. Very well.
Super tense. And the 2011 movie, I actually saw that with Brian. I was so excited to see the prequel, and I wasn't disappointed. It wasn't as good as,
I enjoyed it.
Me too, dude. I thought it paid great homage to John Carpenter's, and, it was good. It was a great prequel. It like kind of like, you know, filled the gaps of that story.
Yeah, I do like how you say, in case anybody hasn't seen it, a movie that came out in 1981. Go see it. If you haven't seen it by now, you're already missing out. But yeah, that's a seriously good pick. It was one of those ones when we talked about it and you said it, I was like, all right, I can't steal that one. That one's got to be like yours alone. But that's another great movie, and I think it's probably John Carpenter's finest work. I'm not a super big knowledgeable person on his body of work, but that movie was so well layered and so well done. And the thing is like some of the scenes, they have just the camera moving around the compound, and he's basically just giving you clues as to what's going on. And to this day, people still debate about what went on and the ending and, you know, who was who and what was what. It's a giant game of chess. That's what the illusion is, especially, and they tell you at the beginning, because Kurt Russell is playing against a computer, and he calls it a cheater and kind of fries the computer with some whiskey or whatever it is, but like, he was playing chess in that scene, and essentially that's what the movie comes down to. It just happens to take place in a frozen tundra where there's no help, and there's, and there's an alien running around that can mimic people, which is pretty phenomenal. And then you get an ending, which is nice and ambiguous. So, it's a great movie all the way around. Fantastic.
Yeah. Talk about freaking, messed up and creepy and like scary. Like the alien can like take your body over even if, like with one cell. So like they had to like prepare their own food. Like the level of like paranoia in the movie's insane. And, it can like, shoot out appendages, like, and spikes and morph into all kinds of different things. So, like, even if this thing touched you, it can, like, prick you and infect you. So, it's a crazy movie, man. If you haven't seen The Thing, I mean, I highly recommend it. It's just a great movie.
And, all of it, too, was, the special effects done in camera, practical effects. So, meaning, you know, we're talking puppetry. You know, everything was made by hand, which I think is what lends itself to the quality of the film. You know, you get a lot of the stuff now, the CGI, and it looks fake or it moves way too fast to understand what it even is. The old horror movies like The Thing, you know, it hangs around. You see the guy when his chest bursts open and stuff. And actually, if you look on YouTube, there's some people that I can't remember who it was, unfortunately. I'm doing a terrible job here, but they do a breakdown and a behind the scenes of the actual special effects that were behind that specific movie. Mm-hmm. And it's quite detailed and fantastic. And the amount of work that went on to create those creatures was pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not to take anything away from like quality CGI, because like to my understanding, it takes months to like generate like, you know, legit looking imagery like with CGI. But man, the amount of time and the effort it takes to like sculpt actual creatures and like use like latex and actual like real fluids with like pumps and, you know, I think it's a more impressive art. I mean, that's my opinion, you know.
Oh, I have to agree too. I think like it's more impressive. It interacts with the scene better and the lighting. You know, a lot of times CGI can look fake. And not only that too, if you make a practical effect, you know, puppetry, whatever you want to call it, like an actual prop, if you don't make it right, that's money wasted. So there's a lot more pressure to perform and be at your best than there is in the computer world. If you CGI something and it doesn't work out the way you want it, what do? You just delete and start over again. You know, it's not as much pressure, but I still think practical in camera effects, you're never going to beat it. I mean, CGI can go so far, but yeah, practical. Can't beat that, and especially The Thing. It's a great movie.
Dude, speaking of CGI, how about the CGI in Civil War when it made Robert Downey Jr. look young? That was like, that's some of the best CGI I've ever seen on screen. Like, it was legit looking. Like I was scrutinizing it, too. I was, like, looking at it, like, I want to see if he looks rubbery or, like, because they did it with Tron Legacy with Jeff Bridges. They made him look younger in that as, like, Clue. But, In Civil War, man, they perfected it. Like, it was, like, so spot on. It also, this is something I thought about, too, dude, and this is, like, a great discussion. And I think we talked about it on this podcast before, but is it, I don't even know if I want to ask this question because it would be, like, a thing that'll probably go on, but How do you feel about bringing actors back from the dead? You know, with the way CGI, now the state of technology with CGI, where you can make it look so realistic. Would you be good with, let's say, bringing back Marlon Brando?
No.
Or would you find it disrespectful?
No. And I'll tell you, I'm going to say no, and I'm going to tell you why, and it may not be for the reason you're thinking of, because there needs to be value in that person's performance that they did in the living. And as soon as you start making things, like I always say, serialized, where you start bringing people back from the dead, then all of a sudden you devalue that person's work, that body of work. And I'm very much, and anybody who's listened to this podcast and listened to me knows that I'm very much into firsts and not necessarily serializing and making the same thing again and again and again. So even somebody who I have a lot of respect for, like Paul Newman or Marlon Brando, no, I wouldn't want, absolutely no way I wouldn't want to see them resurrected. And it's not out of a respect or disrespect. It's simply by the idea that just their initial body of work, what they did in the living world, should stay that and be left alone, because you're going to devalue it. As soon as you bring that shit in there, like if you were able to actually do that, it's going to take their body of work and not make it as strong as what it would be. It's going to make a mockery of it. So no, I'm maybe a purist in that way. If there is such a thing as bringing actors back from the dead.
I mean, I think it's possible, dude. Mimicking the voice might be tricky. I almost think that possibly doing the imagery is actually easier than voice, but I mean, if I can answer the same question, like I think I'm like torn, like, because my selfish side wants to see like Bruce Lee back or you know, some great actor like Marlon Brando, because you always have like the what ifs, like what if they were still here to you know, do this performance or be in that movie. You know, that's my selfish side, but half of me also finds it disrespectful. It's disrespectful to their talent. You know, I don't think you can mimic something what Marlon Brando was able to do like on screen. You know what I mean? It's kind of disrespectful. I mean, ultimately I'd probably be against it.
Yeah, I don't even think that's an answerable question, because I think the question is ludicrous, to be quite frank. You know, let's worry about future generations not bringing people back from the dead. You know, we got the greats. Let's let them lie. You know, leave them where they're at and let them work on the stuff. If you were to bring Bruce Lee back, that wouldn't make him Bruce Lee anymore. It would be some kind of, you know, circus trick or something. And then by that, having a circus trick, people wouldn't hold him in so much esteem. You know what I mean? He wouldn't be held to such, he wouldn't have the same, my favorite word, or actually, Brian's favorite word. He wouldn't have the same gravitas, you know. It wouldn't be that, you know, it wouldn't be Bruce Lee or, you know, Paul Newman or Marlon Brando, whatever the case is anymore. So he's like, oh, we can just recreate him. So it's cheaper than.
Dude, I don't even think the technology's there to mimic Bruce Lee's kicks. You can't capture that speed.
Dude, man. I think, jumping off the rails here, Bruce Lee, to totally jump off the rails, there's a great video, if you can ever find it on YouTube or on the internet somewhere, where they taped like sandpaper to his nunchucks, and they flicked matches at him, and he lit them off of the nunchucks just by hitting him in midair. Like, he had some sick talent, you know?
Yeah, Bruce Lee was amazing, dude. He was just a master at, like, hand-to-hand combat. It's like, you know how someone's a professor at something, you know, like a brilliant mathematician, or this guy dedicated his whole life to like manipulating his body and like, you know, figuring out what's the best ways to beat somebody in a fight. You know, he was amazing. Anyway, moving on. Whose pick is it?
I think it's mine. Because you had, what did you have last? The Thing. Yeah, that was it. So, I'm going to go off on the rails on this one and go towards comedy, because we discussed this and I said, man, there's got to be a comedy in there for me. And I was debating because I love really good classic comedies. But the one I think I would definitely absolutely unequivocally take with me that's a super, super classic, and I just found it in Blu-ray 1080p high def with director commentary, the classic hit Spaceballs. I would so take that down there with me and be reciting lines until the day that I died inside that bunker, pasty white. Mm-hmm. That would be a must bring for me.
Dude, I haven't seen Spaceballs in Oh man, over 10 years, like easily, probably like longer than that, I barely remember the movie. I found it funny when I was younger. I may have to check it out.
You know, I'll lend it to you and, you should watch it sometime soon. Yeah. It's seriously great. I mean, just, you know, the thing back in the, when it was getting made and they had President Scroob. And, he was the bad guy in the movie. And, I remember he took out canned air out of his desk because the big thing is they were going to run out of air. And that was the big draw of the movie, the big whatever it is, plot point. And, in one of the scenes, he took Perry air instead of, you know, like Perrier canned water. It was canned air and he took it out and he was huffing it. And, I just recently in the news, I heard somebody was selling bottles of air to China. So it's one of those things that Mel Brooks predicted the future of canned air. I mean, it's just, not only that too, it's just, it's great. It's literal. It's absurd. It's completely ridiculous. They make fun of idiots and intelligent people alike and plastic surgery, and they make fun of Jewish people and marketing. And they're so open with it too, you know, and they're like, hopefully we'll meet again in the sequel, Spaceballs 2, The Search for More Money, you know, like just great all around comedy, man. I could quote, I think, like every scene from that movie. You know, they're out there combing the desert with the giant comb. He's like, you think we're taking this too literal? And he said, no, he said, comb the desert. We're combing the desert.
Yeah.
You know, just classic stuff.
It's one of those movies along the lines of, I don't even know if the same person made it, but, like the Naked Gun series and, Airplane and.
No, that was a different guy, but.
Is it? But I'm a big Star Wars fan. So, just it being a Star Wars like spoof, you know, I get a kick out of that. So,
and not only that too, Rick Moranis is in it, who's like comedy gold, who doesn't do anything anymore, you know, cause he went to go take care of his children after his wife died of cancer, which is noble. But Rick Moranis is in it. All the supporting cast is great. Bill Pullman's funny.
John Candy.
John Candy. Yeah. Barf, you know, he's a half man, half dog. He's his own best friend. Mm-hmm. You know, everything. The whole thing was just, and Mel Brooks playing, Yogurt the Great, and he also played President Scroob. That was a fantastic movie. I really wish you'd brushed up and seen it before this, but I didn't really tell you I was going to do that. But that's just a classic movie. And a lot of movies nowadays mimic what Mel Brooks used to do. If you watch any of the modern spoof movies, excuse me, they all try to mimic what he did back then so well. But he did it. He was the original, you know, the first one to do it, and he did it real well. And I just don't see it ever getting mimicked again by anybody.
I remember in that film they kind of like made fun of Alien. They had like this little alien creature. I believe I remember bust out of somebody and start dancing with a cane and a top hat. Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling. Like something weird like that. Like the WB frog. It was some weird like scene.
Yeah, that's the thing. So they make fun in the whole movie. They make fun of a lot of movies. So like even too, when the Spaceballs crash down onto the planet, like at the end of Planet of the Apes, the very, very first one, when the humans finally make it to the end, they see a Statue of Liberty and then they realize it's their old planet. And the whole, you know, one of the big jokes at the end of Spaceballs was that, you know, the head of the giant mega maid lady lands in there with her arm up, which looks just like the Statue of Liberty. And they have a whole bunch of apes on horses come up. And they see the Spaceballs come out and they're like, oh shit, there goes the planet, you know?
Yeah.
It's, they made fun of everything. Aliens, Spaceballs, Star Wars.
Yeah, I would like to check it out again, man, and get some chuckles out of it. Yeah, interesting pick, man. I didn't really pick anything fun. I just picked, you know, my faves. My third pick, if you're done with Spaceballs, is Aliens. It's the sequel to Ridley Scott's Alien, and this movie came out in 86, I believe. The follow-up to that, James Cameron directed it, and I thought it was like one of the best sequels like ever made. You know, usually sequels suck ass, to be frank. But Aliens is cool because it didn't try to be like Alien. It just kind of like went in a different direction, and because like Alien was like very claustrophobic and one creature, and then Aliens was kind of like a action movie, sci-fi action movie. And it was just well done, man. And Cameron, like, added to the story, added, like, a queen alien and a different, like, view of, like, the alien life cycle. Cause in the first movie, it was, like, a big mystery, you know? But that's one of my favorite movies. Definitely top 10 of all time. I'm very biased to it. It's nostalgic for me because I remember watching it as a kid. So I would take that into a bunker with me. Aliens.
It is a great war movie, you know. I had fun. I know we had a long discussion on another podcast about Alien and Aliens and the other ones that were made in the future ones. But I still hold to this day that I had fun with Aliens. I still think cinematically, obviously I'm going to say this, the first one is just, I think, more well put together. But it's just my style, I think, more. But the second one is still a fun movie to watch. It's still well done too. It's a quality movie. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trashing or anything. It's a fun movie. And like you said, it's more of like, in the thicket, in the jungle, fighting it out, you know, having a true like fist to fist, battle, you know.
Yeah. I remember, watching a special features or it was an interview that I read or in a special features where, James Cameron wanted to do the whole high-tech versus low-tech angle, and it was supposed to mimic, like, Vietnam. So, technically, on paper, we were supposed to dominate, like, win Vietnam, you know what I mean? And these people, they proved to be very formidable because they had no quit in them, and they just, like, it was like the aliens in the movie Aliens. Like, you know, they were very low-tech, but they were, like, relentless and came at you, like, in swarms, and the high-tech Marines with all the gadgets and stuff were getting just decimated in the movie, you know? There's a lot going on in that movie.
Yeah, it's a good choice, honestly. I wouldn't be upset if somebody said you have to go into a bunker and this is one of them and you have to take this with you. I thoroughly enjoyed that movie. Actually, I really want to rewatch it because we covered it a few podcasts ago and we're bringing it up again. So it's one of those ones that's been on my brain here lately to watch and to kind of revisit,
dude,
you know, view it with adult eyes, as I like to say.
Yeah, dude, out of the Alien franchise, like, I'll do this every now and again. Like, I'll watch Alien, Aliens, and then I'll watch Alien 3. Alien 3 gets a super bad rap. It's by, I think his name is David Fincher. He's a guy who did Fight Club, and he recently did Gone Girl, which is a great movie.
Agreed.
Alien 3 is a... It's not a terrible movie to me. It got shitted on so bad, but I thought it was a decent Alien sequel. Alien Resurrection was just freaking terrible. That's the fourth one. That was like blasphemy. That should have never been made. You know, everybody who worked in that movie should be hung. But Alien 3 was okay, but definitely every now and again I'll do Alien and then Aliens because both movies are linked so well, too.
Yeah. It's one of those rare cases, funny, involving James Cameron again, where the first and the sequel are both really quality movies. You know, you got Terminator, Terminator 2, then you got Alien and Aliens, so.
Which is rare. Yeah. It's
It's super rare. And the fact that it happened with the same director, mm-hmm. at least on the sequels, is even more bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shows Cameron's talent.
But maybe it did. I don't know about much anymore. I don't know, like, you know, his newer stuff kind of is trailing off for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's getting a bit gimmicky, but.
Avatar was like a gimmick. It wasn't a bad movie, but what pulled people in was like the effects, and it was like new at the time, you know?
Well, the problem is, so like he even admitted to with Titanic, he basically just wanted straight up how he pitched the movie to the executives was, what's the two star-crossed lovers? Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
He goes, Romeo and Juliet on a boat. And they go, okay. And I don't know how the meeting went for Avatar, but I can only imagine he went, okay, Last of the Mohicans in space. You know, that's pretty much what the movie is. It's identical, I think, to Last of the Mohicans. So I think his storytelling has kind of gone downhill quite a bit, but it's flashy enough. I enjoyed it for like what it is. Like I wanted to go live on Pandora when I saw Avatar, but I didn't think it was that compelling. And I also think that actor, that main dude, Sam Worthington. Yeah, he's a cardboard box, man. He is one of the worst actors out there right now.
He's very wooden. I actually liked him in Clash of the Titans. Like, for that movie, I grew up watching the original, and I remember when they first announced Clash of the Titans, I was like, eh. Liam Neeson was in it. I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. But he did okay for that movie. But overall, I agree with you. He's pretty wooden. He was in Terminator Salvation also. He was kind of like, eh.
Yeah, another bad movie.
And his career just kind of tanked.
Well, I don't think it tanked, to be honest with you. I think what it is he got signed up for 4 or whatever it is, Avatar sequels, and he's probably making more money than he ever has, so he's probably taken a break. I mean, I know he was living in his car for a long time before he got that Avatar deal, so he's probably just living it up right now. You know, he's got paychecks to come. But to kind of go back, who went last? What was the
Let me see. I picked Aliens.
So that's what it was.
That was my third.
All right. Well, I'm gonna throw one in there if you're okay with that. Another one. And this is gonna be something we kind of came across the issue today as we were discussing bringing this up. And even though I set up not really the rules but the idea for it, I'm gonna slightly bend them a little bit. Because if I just get a choice of a DVD, honestly, it's gonna be the entire series of Lost, the TV show, if we can do it. Because somebody just said, all right, you got to pick out, you know, 5 DVDs. I'm going to grab the box set of Lost as well, too. That is one of my, probably my favorite all-time TV show. Because I just don't, and that's not saying necessarily a lot because I don't really like a lot of TV shows. Hopefully you can't hear the dogs running around in the background. But Lost is a phenomenal show that's very rewatchable, that's super layered, it's got great character development, there's always something different going on, it dabbles in science and in religion, in faith, in reason, and all these elements work together to make a really well-taught, like very stressed, like very well-done TV show. So I would take that with me,
You can do whatever you want, dude, it's a nuclear bunker. You're gonna be down there forever.
Yeah.
I wouldn't hate on you. I'd be like, go ahead, dude. You've mentioned Lost a few times. I'm always up for like a good show. Right now I'm like super into Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead, so I don't know if I can get into anything right now, but if it's that good, I'll definitely check it out.
It's like I said, it's a solid show. I think you don't really find much of it on TV. I think when people normally say they find a great TV show, it's usually like really, really off one end and they just think it's great. And I don't necessarily think it's that great because you have like, let's say Super Gore or when everybody was bragging about how awesome True Blood was, I'm like, this is a joke of a show.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that I don't think just because you have like newts and fairies and witches or whatever the hell, because my wife actually watched that show for a few seasons, and even after a while she was like, yeah, this is just kind of turned to shit. So it's one of those things, like, you know, like I said, a lot of TV shows I have issues with, and they try to be too serial and they try to be too repetitive. And in Lost, and I've heard this too, and I think we discussed this about Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. any character can kind of get killed off mm-hmm. at any point in time.
Right.
You know, it's a proper mystery.
Yeah, nobody's safe, dude.
Yeah, and too, like I said as well before, the island itself in Lost mm-hmm. plays its own character. It is its own character, you know, which is truly fascinating to watch the development of that interact with the people over time. And I literally mean this over time. And if you've seen the whole show, you know what I mean. As the people, you know, go throughout their stay at the island, it develops with them. They develop with it, and the whole interaction between all of them, man, I could seriously probably watch that forever. And I think it's about 6 seasons long, too. Mm. So, I mean, there's at least, you know, a couple of years of TV to watch.
Yeah. The greatest TV series I've ever seen is probably Breaking Bad. Like, for me, I really enjoyed Dexter. There's a lot of series that I like, but Breaking Bad, to me, is the best one that I've ever seen so far.
Maybe. I wish, man. I tried. We watched it, and it's just, I think the problem with me is the subject matter of Breaking Bad. And it's one of those things that it's such a well done show and I can appreciate it so much and I love it. But then it's just a story about a dude dealing meth, which doesn't really interest me. You know what I mean? It's one of those things that, all right, well, just move to Canada, you know, like get your health care up there, move to France, you know, the United Kingdom, you know, and it's just a thing of killing people for drug money and all this other stuff. Like, I really didn't get past the first season.
Yeah.
And,
well, he was doing it to not to cut you off, but he was doing it to secure like a, you know, like a small fortune for his family so they'll be okay when he dies. I mean, that was kind of like his main motivation. I loved it, man. I don't know. To each their own, though.
Yeah, no, I wish I did, because, like I said, when I was watching it, I can pick up on a lot of stuff, the director, and I can't remember his name, or the writer, the writer guy, what he was doing and what they were putting in there was fantastic. It was phenomenal. It was really well done. And this is one of the only times I can think of it where I see something that's cinematically fantastic, but just the theme itself just really is something just I wasn't interested in. It's kind of like when somebody tells me about, you know, fairy tale movies, you know, Once Upon a Time or whatever. I honestly just can't, my brain just doesn't get into it, just doesn't jam with it for some reason. And, you know, like meth dealing and stuff, like, I don't know, it's just like, it's not that I'm against it. Like I said, some of my favorite movies involve, you know, all that subject matter, but it was just one of those things that, I don't know, it never grabbed me. And people always say, we gotta get past the first season, dude. Just get past the first season and it picks up. And if you're telling, I have this firm belief too, this mantra more or less, that if you're telling somebody that they have to wait and invest time because the beginning isn't that great, then the show as a whole isn't that great. Cause it should be, especially a TV show, right from the word go, amazing. You know, if you watch the first episode or the first two episodes of Lost, which is basically the first one episode, is that way? Because it was pilot one and pilot two. By the time you get to the end of that pilot episode, you are so confused about what's going on. There's so much happening. And if it doesn't grab you right there, then it's lost. But I mean, you know, that's what I said. So when I watched Lost for the first time, that first few episodes, I was like, oh my God, that's fantastic. And I want to see more. I watched Breaking Bad and I was like, all right, I guess we'll keep watching it.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
In Breaking Bad's defense, I mean, there's a lot that goes on, like in the later seasons, that the first two seasons or the first one, it just pales in comparison. Like, there's a lot of tension build up, and like, I don't want to spoil it for you, like, if you revisit it, but there's a lot that goes on. And it's funny because in script writing, you know, I like to write and stuff as a hobby. You know, I have aspirations with writing, but this is something that I learned with script writing, is you have to get the reader's or the viewer's attention within the first 8 to 10 pages. So you have to kind of like set something up where it kind of like hooks them. So with Breaking Bad, I think it's the same way with the shows, where they have to have a writing style where the first episode or two like hooks the viewer. But I think with Breaking Bad, I don't know if they did it on purpose. It's like rolling thunder. Like the more you watch, the crazier it gets. So they definitely don't. I don't think it's written to hook you in the first two or three. You just got to stick with it. And then the more you go, the more invested you are. Like, holy crap. Like, what's going to happen to this guy? Or like, I can't believe that happened. And so I don't know.
It's a shame too, because Bryan Cranston is so unbelievably good.
Yeah.
There's a scene where he's like in his underwear and he's debating shooting himself or shooting this car coming at him. I can't totally remember the scene, but he thinks in his mind that he's been found out by the police or something.
That was the first segment.
Yeah, it was so intense. His acting was so unbelievably good, and he went through the emotions properly. Like, I always have issues with actors with over-emoting everything, their externalities on their face and stuff. And he was so perfectly understated, and it was just, that was one of my all-time favorite just acting scenes of just somebody on the screen earned his fucking paycheck, as far as I'm concerned, you know? That was, I do remember that.
Yeah, he's phenomenal, dude. And to think about his, you know, his earlier career, he was on Malcolm in the Middle. He wasn't considered like some amazing actor. And then to go from that to getting a letter from, I believe, Anthony Hopkins, and Anthony Hopkins, you know, telling him in his letter, you're one of the greatest actors I've ever seen. Like, yeah. You know, on screen, that's like an Academy Award right there. Like, yeah. For Anthony Hopkins to say that to you, you know, I mean, that's crazy. And I think that's what he said, too. He said that was like winning an Academy Award to me. Like,
well, you know, the only reason he got picked, too, is because the writer, and I wish I could remember his name. My internet's going really slow. My computer's clogging up, so I can't really look this stuff up. But the guy who did it said he was directing an episode of The X-Files. He directed many episodes of The X-Files way back in the day. In one of the episodes, he had Bryan Cranston on as like a character, a criminal or a bad guy or something like that. And he says in that one instance that he worked with him for that one episode, he was so blown away, which was like 15, 20 years before Breaking Bad ever came out. He said he was so impressed that he wanted to recruit him. And he basically campaigned for Bryan Cranston to get the role. And all the executives are like, we can't have the family dude from Malcolm in the Middle. And it's so funny because he came out and just blew everybody away with his performance. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a top notch, you know, especially coming from Preparation H commercials.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Preparation H. And dude, like I was genuinely happy when I saw him getting roles on a silver screen. Like, you know, from his Breaking Bad fame, you know, he was in Drive. I was excited he starred in Godzilla, even though he didn't have the biggest role. You know, he wasn't throughout the whole movie, but I'm really happy for him, and he's going to be starring in some other movie coming up, so he got, like, future roles ahead, you know, so he's so talented, man.
I agree. Anyway,
whose pick? My pick, right?
Yep.
So this is my fourth pick, and these are, again, in not any specific order, but this is one of my favorite movies of all time. I can watch it over and over, just, like, awesome performances, great crime film, Training Day. Came out in 2001, stars Denzel Washington, Ethan Hawke, and I love that movie to death, man. I think, you know, like when certain actors, they play a role that kind of like, it's the apex of their career. Like it kind of defines them as an actor. Like I think Denzel Washington's portrayal of like Alonzo Harris, man, and it was like one of the, I think it's the first time Denzel played a bad guy. And actually won him an Academy Award. So,
yeah, it did.
What an awesome movie, man.
Yeah, it was a pretty great movie. I mean, unfortunately, I haven't seen it in a long time, so I don't remember too much about it. But I do remember, you know, Godzilla ain't got shit on me.
Yeah.
Or no, King Kong.
King Kong. It's King Kong. King Kong ain't got shit on me.
Yeah, it was. I remember watching it. Just like at some point, I expected him to turn and be like, "Hey, Ethan, I'm just playing around. This is just my initiation for you." And then him ended up being a good guy, which the great part was is that never happened. He was just literally that bad of a dude. You know, he was the bad guy.
Yeah, dude, he's one of the greatest like schemers like in movie history. Just like plotting and scheming and just it was a great performance by him and. There was something I was going to say about it. Oh, yeah, the whole movie, all the shit that takes place in that movie happens in a span of one day, Training Day. And it was amazing because the movie starts off with sunrise, with Ethan Hawke waking up on his first day on the job, you know, in his new role, like a trainee under Denzel for this, like, new division or task force. And the movie ends, you know, in the same day, like sunset. You know, and he goes home, and it's so much shit happens throughout the course of one day. Like, that was another aspect of the movie that I found, like, incredible. But it's worth a revisit, dude. You should check it out.
Yeah, I think I will. I mean, I remember I definitely enjoyed it at the time. Mm-hmm. It was definitely a quality movie, you know. Definitely not a bad one. It's funny, too, because Ethan Hawke, you know, I didn't really expect him to be in anything that was Academy Award winning, like, yeah. You know. But, yeah, he came out and that was, no, maybe that wasn't Denzel's. Didn't he win an Academy for, his role in Glory? He might have. I'd have to look up.
He might have. I think, no, I really think Training Day was his first. Like, at least for, like, lead actor.
It might have been.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. Maybe that's what it was. Cause I remember him, when he was in, Glory and he's getting whipped and he's crying with no emotion on his face. That was like the mic drop of acting. You know, that was some serious shit. Maybe you're right. That might have been a supporting role, but not a lead.
Yeah.
Academy Award. But, Training Day was a pretty cool movie.
So that's my fourth.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and kick it off with my last and certainly not least movie, because I wanted to save my big one for the end, which if anybody's listened to this, they probably know where I'm going. Even my wife was like, well, yeah, no shit, when I told her the list before I came to do this podcast. Is
Transformers.
Is the greatest movie, Steven Spielberg. Yeah, exactly. Michael Bay, Dutch angles, low to the ground, spinning around cars. I mean, you can't get any better.
I knew it, dude.
You just do that in every single scene. You make $1 million, and then you get everybody sick to their stomach and devalue cinematography.
Explosions. You forgot that.
Yeah, that's right. Explosions, too, which I don't have a problem with. I have mainly a big problem with his cinematography. His spinning cameras just kill me. It's one of those things that's like, okay, I know you can do it, but you don't have to do it in every scene. You know, if there's a touching moment, you don't need the camera zipping around at like 400 miles an hour, like a tilt-a-whirl at the, you know, local fucking festival. But no. Steven Spielberg in an interview said there's, in movie history, there's every film made before 2001 A Space Odyssey and every film after 2001 A Space Odyssey. He said it was a seminal movie that changed filmmaking permanently forever. And I'd have to agree. I mean, such a big statement isn't something I would mimic, because that seems more grandiose. Steven Spielberg can make that kind of comment. I don't think I can, but I do think it is absolutely, probably, if I could make a favorite movie on a list, which I don't like to do, probably would be my favorite. Just a classic, good, high quality, brilliant, layered movie. I mean, just so well done. You know, absolutely would be going down with me. And I'd probably bring like 2 copies just in case the one broke.
Dude, what did the guy at the end of the movie? He became like the star baby. Like, was that the
star
term?
Child? Yeah,
star
yeah.
Child. I'm gonna rewatch that, dude, because I remember when I saw it, I was like really trying to pay attention to everything and soak it all in, and I forgot a lot about it. But I remember it being really deep and like just insane. There was like a monolith, right? Like with like primates, and like the movie kind of like hinted at like our beginnings. Like it was just like such a crazy out there movie.
So the great thing about the movie is that sometimes you'll see like double narratives in a film where you say, okay, well, in Captain America Civil War, that whole thing that they're, you know, the Sokovia Accords that they're fighting about is really just an allegory for the big government, small government argument that we have going on in modern U.S. culture. So that's a double narrative. You know, you have one main narrative, they're fighting the Sokovia Accords, but it really represents, for the director's point of view, it really represents our modern political stance issues, whatever. Stanley Kubrick, in this movie, had double, triple, quadruple narratives going on all at the same time, and I have honestly never seen another movie do that ever to the extent that he did, and it executed so exquisitely well. So, yeah, you can take, you know, and it's one of those things that I tell you about, that a lot of movie analysis, personally, what I believe is that it's a large reflection of your own life's experiences kind of projected up onto the screen, but it combined with the idea of what the director has to say and what he's leading you to, and not to ramble on about it, but it's an awesome movie. But you can take the beginning with the chimpanzees as being, that's how we became who we are. And it kind of sort of saying more or less too that monolith is what triggered human evolution. And not saying it in like any factual science base. It's just obviously a science fiction story. But, you know, it's a great representation. There's a pack of apes and they're trying to drink at a watering hole. And then a bigger, more intimidating pack of apes comes in. And this is in the very beginning. And, you know, the bigger, more intimidating apes drive them away. And they take it, they're submissive, and you know, they're sad and sullen or whatever. And then one of them gets the bright idea to go to go up to the monolith and touch it like you would a frosted pole in the middle of winter, you know. And when he does, it gives him the idea that he can use a bone from a dead chimp as a weapon, and he regains control of the watering hole and obviously his pack of chimpanzees. And it transitions from that to obviously our kind of modern exploration of space human. And then, you know, we touch the monolith and then it transitions from there. But all that, like I said, is heavily, heavily layered with other nuanced storytelling techniques. That's you just kind of have to watch, I think, a few times the movie to pick it all up. Mm-hmm. Not to ramble on, sorry.
Dude, I'm probably going to rewatch that this weekend. I think I'll have a lot of fun revisiting that, and it was so deep, and yeah, I think I would enjoy that again, because I forgot a lot about it. I remember I was blown away.
I'll lend it to you. I'll tell you what, you guys can mark the occasion right here on the podcast. I have it in 1080 on Blu-ray, as well, I also have it in, like, it came in a 3-pack from Walmart. You can't beat Walmart, right? A 3-pack from Walmart for like $5. Mm-hmm. It had The Shining. It had 2001 A Space Odyssey, and it had A Clockwork Orange. You just can't beat that.
Damn, dude. That's
good stuff right there.
I've seen bits of A Clockwork Orange, but it didn't capture me, man. I don't know. I couldn't finish it for whatever reason.
You should retry it again. Like,
oh, what's the lead actor's name? Not to cut you off. He's been in a lot of movies.
Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome. They actually scratched his retina, I think, permanently, shooting that very, very famous scene where he has his eyes pried open, and they're training him to get rid of his violent tendencies or sexual tendencies or whatever it is.
Taking the fun out of his life.
Yeah, what's life without a good hobby, like, you know, sexual aggression or whatever? But, yeah, you know, it's just, honestly, he's one of the greatest directors of all times. Anytime you see a top 100 list or a top 50 list, he's always in there with directors. You know, you're always going to have a Stanley Kubrick up there, and he was very good too with psychological triggers as well. Like, if you know The Shining pretty well, right?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like in the scenes where Jack Nicholson's character is just staring into the camera, mm-hmm. and he's just staring and staring, and they hold that shot for god awful like a minute and a half or something. And what it is it makes you psychologically uneasy, mm-hmm. and it's not a tilted camera, it's not a shaky camera, it's not like a fast zoom in or anything like modern cheap techniques that try to tell you that something's wrong with him or like an overacting character. He sits on that actor's face, and they do this in 2001 A Space Odyssey as well too, and they just let you sit there and soak in the emotion of him going crazy, very much like the director who did Drive. You know, you can actually see the similarities between Kubrick's style and the director who did Drive are actually, you know, pretty obvious, I think.
I think I remember that scene. Was he sitting at the bar, like by himself, kind of looking off?
I'm pretty sure it was at the bar. We just watched it recently, too.
Kind of had
that movie.
I think his mouth was open. He kind of looked like all stoic, like spaced out. And I think I remember. It was a really uneasy scene. And props to Jack Nicholson's acting chops, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You should see the behind-the-scenes footage of when they made The Shining. Mm-hmm. You could also probably watch the behind-the-scenes, too, if we're talking about 2001, if you can go find it. But there's a video on YouTube that Stanley Kubrick's daughter made with, like, a standard, like, a handheld 8mm film or something like that, mm-hmm. behind the scenes. And how Jack Nicholson got into his character is terrifying. You know, like he basically sat behind the stage. You know, they're in a sound stage, and he's in a back room, and he's just spazzing out, and he's just repeating words like murderer, killer, rapist, murderer, killer, and he gets himself so worked up, and then he goes out there, you know, and they give him an axe, and he just goes right into the scene and just starts to go bonkers. Holy God. it's pretty crazy how he got himself to wherever he went to.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
but. Are you ready for my fifth pick, sir?
Shoot.
So my last pick is, it's a fun movie. I love it. Grew up with it. I think it's one of the greatest films like ever made. Some people call me crazy. Some people would agree with it. But it's going to be, Jurassic Park.
Like, I knew it.
Dude, I love Jurassic Park to death. I can watch it over and over. It's so well done. It was groundbreaking as far as like effects, like animatronics with CGI blend. I remember being a kid and like really thinking like I'm looking at dinosaurs. Yep. Like, and I was just like in awe. Like I was like just, and dude, how about the marketing for Jurassic Park at the time? It was freaking genius. Like
yeah.
Jurassic Park was everywhere. Like, it was everywhere. Yep. It was a big hoopla about it. But just
it was on McDonald's movie. Cups.
Taco Bell, everywhere, dude, everywhere. Everything was dinosaur. Like at that time.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was huge. And Jurassic Park to me is one of those movies where, like, if I'm talking to you, like, and I know opinions are opinions and everybody's entitled to them. And we talk about this, you know, sometimes like off air, but it's one of those movies that if somebody says Jurassic Park totally sucked, I'd be like, you suck. Your brain sucks. Like something's
it's
wrong.
It's time for a throwdown.
Yeah, like
somebody's getting their ass beat.
Dude, something is fundamentally wrong with that person's brain. Like, I could understand you don't like Jurassic Park for whatever reason, but to say that it's a bad movie or it sucks, it cannot possibly suck. I don't care who you are. It's a freaking amazing film. That's my view.
It's a masterpiece.
It's a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece, yeah, dude. It really is. But that's my fifth pick, and I can watch that movie to the day I die and probably, you know, probably not get too bored of it.
Yeah, I would support your decision wholeheartedly to bring that down. That was actually one of the ones on my list, but it wasn't like on my list, but we discussed it, and it was one of those things that I had other ones that I wanted to put in there. Like, if I'm truly going down, I got to bring in a couple of Kubricks and stuff, but Jurassic Park, man, that holds something special. I think, especially in our generation, you know, people in their 30s and probably in their 40s will really understand the magnitude of when that came out and how it pushed the idea that, you know, we're at the point in technology where we can make these things look absolutely real, and everybody thought the dinosaurs were real. And it was one of the most terrifying PG-13 movies I ever saw when I was growing up.
They pushed.
If you think about it. Yeah, like I used to sit down and watch Predator with no problem, and that was an R-rated because it was just gore on gore, you know, whatever. But that was so well tightly done, and, you know, that lamb leg landing on top of the glass and them being pushed under the car and all that stuff, especially like when the kids are running from the velociraptors in the kitchen and they're trying to get through and you can see their breath. I mean, that – this is, again, too, to not jump off, but, you know, the new Jurassic World – is that what it's called? The new stuff with Chris Pratt? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that stuff, man. That's what it's missing. It's missing the first Jurassic Park. When you watch it, anybody can die, right? At any given time, somebody can die. And it gives you that kind of fear. And it's very dark and it's edgy. And I watched Jurassic World recently, and I think we talked about this before. I was hoping somebody would die. Some of the characters, the main characters were actually pretty annoying, but, they got rid of that fear. They made it, you know, again, they made it too soft in the modern Hollywood age. You know, it's just, you know, nobody's going to die in this movie except for characters that don't even have any lines. You know, that's one of those things they missed. Jurassic Park was an absolute masterpiece of sci-fi.
It was.
Direction writing.
It was 100%. My issue with Jurassic World, I actually like Jurassic World. I own it. I thought it was way better than The Lost World and the third Jurassic Park. But my thing with Jurassic World is, and it may not even be the film's fault, it's just like, Jurassic Park was like the first of its kind. It was like, when you first saw that movie, it was completely new to you. You never seen dinosaurs like that, or like, you know, on screen, it was just like amazing. You were just like, wow, you know? And it's like the first Matrix, like nobody really knew like what the Matrix was about. Like, what is the Matrix? Like, remember the marketing for that? Not to cut you off, but after you find out what the Matrix is about and you're wowed by the first movie, the second and third can't really do that to you, you know? Like, so it's like with Jurassic Park, like, it was a one-shot deal. You saw the first one. If you were lucky enough to go to the theater, you were amazed by it. And then it's like that initial wonder, you know, what's going on here is like lost because you already saw. You know what it's about. You've seen the dinosaurs already, you know? So the same thing with The Lost World, not to keep ranting. Is this like, it just was like Jurassic Park redone, but like poorly, like not as good.
Yeah, no, I agree. And this is what we talk about. And unfortunately you're supporting the Hollywood drug habit of becoming serialized movie makers where they're too afraid to kill off anybody or to stop something because the potential for money making is so, so strong. So You know, it's funny too, is I was just watching a film breakdown about this. It's called Intertextualities. And it's like referencing stuff. You know, it's all the Star Wars. It's all jokes inside of jokes. It's, you know, rehashing all the Jurassic Park movies. And that's kind of those things, because they're bringing you back because you get like a certain type of like addictive reaction to it. You're waiting for this thing to be verified on screen with you, if that makes any sense. And when you see it, you get like a sense of relief or whatever the case is, or a sense of elation from seeing it. And so people just keep paying to go see these Jurassic Park movies or whatever it is, any sequel really. And it's just, they're just tearing them apart as far as I'm concerned. I'm a purist. I think they should have made Jurassic Park and left it at that. They should have just left it alone. That was a masterpiece. They don't come along often. That lives in movie history. You know, that's, hang on to your butts. You can't beat that, man. And they should have never made any of the sequels. Forget the second and the third. Forget Jurassic World. They should have just left it at Jurassic Park. Done. That's it.
Dude, Jurassic Park. Okay. The whole thing with like, sequels and like going back to franchises, when you damn well know that it's not going to be as good as the first one. It's like, it's similar to, like, this is going to sound totally messed up, when you have like a deadbeat dad. Like they make all these broken.
You're right. It does sound bad.
No, dude, it does. Well, okay. Follow me here. Like, so you have a dad that's just like a freaking loser, and he like makes all these promises to you. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to pick you up Saturday. We're going to go to the zoo and we're going to do this. And you're like waiting. You're all excited, and he doesn't show up. So it's almost like we saw Jurassic Park, we loved it, we were amazed by it, then they promise us a sequel that's going to deliver just as well, and then we go see it and we're let down because it's not as good as the first, you know. And but we keep going back because we crave, you know, we want to revisit that world and be like, you know, amazed. We just want more because it was so good. But you know, that's the problem. Like, it'll never be repeated. Same thing with right. The Matrix, Jurassic Park. You can go down the list, dude. The only movies that somewhat, the only franchises, and we just mentioned them, it was like Aliens. That was, it wasn't a bad sequel. It wasn't bad. Terminator 2, yeah. It wasn't bad. It was the different kind of movie.
It was enjoyable.
Yeah, but it's rare. It's so freaking rare, man.
Right, which to me, because it's so rare, means that it should not be attempted, especially with great movies.
Right.
You know, that's the thing. They just should have left it alone. And it's, to be more accurate, instead of a deadbeat dad, I would say it's more like a heroin addiction. It's one of those things where you're constantly searching for the high again, but you never get as high as you were the first point. That's from what I hear. I don't know. I only tried heroin once, so that high was super good. But that's kind of that thing. And that's what Hollywood relies on that. You know, they want you to come back and keep going. And when they do that, unfortunately, if they were making quality movies, I don't think I would have a problem. But they keep making shit movies because they don't want anybody to die, and they just want it to be really glossy and very friendly, and they want to get as many people coming in as they can, and it just devalues it. It devalues the first movie, all the work Steven Spielberg and the team at ILM put into it. That's my view.
The thing is, too, is like smart moviegoers, like, you know, they know that the companies, like, their motivations, man, are disingenuous. Like, it's not about, you know, providing a sequel that's going to live up to the original. It's about making money. Like, and if you have half a brain, you know, that's what they're doing, you know, and it's like, it's disappointing.
Well, it is. You know, and it wouldn't be too bad if they came out and they go, all right, we want to make money. But if they made something that was like the first Jurassic Park, that basically had Oscar buzz or whatever the case, I'd have to look up to see if it won anything, but, you know, that was something so heralded, they actually put time and effort into it rather than just picking the closest script that came cheapest that fell right at their doorstep the next day, then, yeah, I'd be okay with it. But the problem is that they don't do that. They make it, and they just make it for the money, get whatever director they can in, get whatever actor they can in that has a decently high profile, like Chris Pratt or whatever, who just got off Guardians of the Galaxy.
Who's hot.
And all they want to do is, very hot. And, you know, and they're just going to make it as cheaply as they can for whatever the case is. And it's one of those things, like, they need to invest more money into quality storylines. And I wouldn't have a problem with it then. But they're not doing that. They're just making garbage movies one after the other. That's why I just watched the first Jurassic Park and that's it. I'd join you in your cellar. We'd have connected nuclear bunkers with a door, and then we could go back and forth on the movies. I'd borrow Jurassic Park a lot.
And it sounds like I'm shitting on Jurassic World. I like Jurassic World. I mean, I own Jurassic World. I liked it. I thought it was better than the other Jurassic Park sequels, but it was okay. You know what I mean? And you know what else is funny? They tried to make, okay, the T-Rex is a super iconic screen character. You know what I mean? So
Yeah. They
tried to make another new iconic character with the Blue Raptor. Like, you know, he was like the hero, like all extra smart. My boy Blue. Yeah. It didn't work. Like, I mean, he was cool. He was kind of unique, but you know, it's not like you didn't recreate another, you know.
No, it was too much like Air Bud, you know, the dog that plays fucking basketball. Yeah. You know, that's what it was too much like. It was like, oh, this Velociraptor talks to humans and he's going to help us fight the T-Rex. We were actually laughing. We were watching it. We got the movie. We didn't buy it, but we got the movie. We were watching it in the living room, and when it was actually like communicating and buddying up with the humans against its own kind, it was one of those things like we were laughing. I mean, it looked like a joke. It was super corny.
Dude, you know what was a joke? when thinking back, like the last scene when they defeat the Indominus Rex, which it was kind of fun. You know, seeing old school versus new school and the two, you know, older breed, you know, of dinosaurs like defeated the new, you know, unstoppable, genetically spliced Indominus Rex. They drove it back to the water and the big crocodile thing ate it. So at the end of the movie, Blue, the raptor, is like looking at the T-Rex, the old T-Rex, and they like acknowledge each other like they're boys. Like it was like so ridiculous, dude. It's like, give me a break. Like the T-Rex would have ate him. Like it's an animal. Like they looked at each other and it's like you go sort of like an eyebrow up. Like, all right, thank you. I won't eat you right now. Like we're cool for now, but I don't know about next time. Like it was just
Hey, thanks. I know we hate each other, and at the end of the first movie, it was a big point that I ate you, but I'm gonna let you go this time because that other guy was an asshole. Yeah, it was
friends.
No, it's that's what they call, and I don't mean to be pretentious here, but that's anthropomorphizing. They're making things anthropomorphic, and they're taking too much human characteristics into those creatures. Those dinosaurs would have never been like that, and that's why I said we were actually laughing when they did that whole end sequence that you were talking about. Like, we were laughing out loud at the movie, which we hardly ever do at any movies, and that's when it was like, it isn't too great, but they're trying to make them like humans. They're making them anthropomorphic. Because it kind of, you know, it brings, like I said, it brings that, like, Air Bud thing in, you know, where it's like, oh, look, a dog who can dribble a basketball. He's like a human, you know.
Yeah.
A velociraptor that can talk to a T-Rex because they get along and they know that they have to fight a common good, you know, or a common evil, whatever. Yeah, that movie lost me. I didn't like it at all.
They honestly would have all tore each other apart. There would have been no teaming up. There would have been no T-Rex and Raptor versus the Indominus. They would have just ate each other up like they're animals, you know.
And Chris Pratt would have been dead. Those kids would have been dead. That girl in the high heels would have been the first to go. Yeah, it wouldn't have ended up that way. It was just, it was cheesy.
With all that being said, I still watch it for entertainment value. I didn't think it was a bad movie. One thing that I really liked about Jurassic World was like the nods to the original. There was a lot of like little, they paid homage to it for the Jurassic Park fans. And I like stuff like that. You know, I'm a sap for that kind of crap. You know, the wall murals that was in the movie, the goggles, and so that was kind of cool. But anyway, that's my fifth pick. I have nothing else. I have to pee, sir. Do you have anything else?
Same as usual. No, that's good. I think we covered it. We'll have to do volume two, like all you right, said, because there's a lot of movies to cover.
Oh, yeah. We could definitely cover more movies, and we got to get Brian and the rest of the crew on here. It should be fun. Like, I'm legitimately curious what they would pick. So it should be
interesting.
Yeah, it would be fun. But for you guys listening, thank you for tuning in. Thanks for the play, subscriptions. Follow us on Facebook. You can add us on there. New Breed Film Reviews. We have a Twitter page, at New Breed Podcast. Email us with feedback, requests. Subscribe on iTunes if you like the podcast, and leave us feedback. We're big on feedback. Again, really appreciate the following. Don, it was awesome, you know, doing this episode with you. It was a great idea. You got anything in closing?
Thanks for having me.
All right.
No, just the same old, same old. I can't believe you guys actually still have me on here talking. So anybody willing to listen, thanks for making it this far and hanging out with us. You know, it's always good to be here and talking movies. You can't go wrong, dude.
Don, don't be so modest and humble, dude. You know your film stuff. You're a great addition to the podcast, and you definitely bring something awesome to the table. Because I'm just like the movie retarded guy. Like, I'm like smart, but I just, you know, you're like the true film connoisseur. You know what I mean? You know your stuff, and it's great to have that dynamic on the podcast. But anyway,
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for being on. So that's gonna wrap up 109. And for you listeners, we'll be back with 110 with some more fun movie stuff. So, good night, Dom.
Good night.